Welcome to the after party. It's time to change. You're just getting started. You can teach an old dog new ways, and not just on Saturdays.
Hey guys, it's Anna David here. I am doing something I have never done before. That sounds so exciting, but all I really mean is that my guest just left, and I'm just recording the intro and outro now. I was so excited. It was such a good conversation that it's like, well, usually what I'll do is I'll take the interview and I'll put it on my computer and then I'll do something else. And I know I have to do the intro and the outro, and I'm like, oh, I should think about it. I should do it later. And then I do 17 or 170 other things. And then 3 days later, I'm like, oh, fuck, I never did the intro. So I figured the recording equipment is sitting right here. And he was so great and so fun. And I love interviewing anybody for this podcast, but it's fun. It's especially fun when it's somebody that that I'm really excited about. And should I get in? I'm just trying to think before I build up to that. I'm just trying to think if there's anything I need to talk to you guys about. He and I got into this in the interview, but definitely having an interesting experience with my brain today, specifically today. I mean, it's been interesting experiences with my brain, you know, for a long time, and in the last week going through something, but today I've reached this point where I am feeding myself this completely false thought. I'm feeding myself this scary thought, where I think I need to control something that not only do I not need, I think I need a certain outcome on something that I don't know if I need a certain outcome on it. It's really debatable. And not only do I think I need it, but I think I can control it. And so I'll have a thought like, I'm so depressed because I want this thing and like, I'm not getting it and I want to control it. And then I have to go, you don't even know if it's a good thing to want. And besides, aren't you supposed to be totally surrendered on everything? And it's just interesting because it hasn't come up like this in a while. And it hasn't come up at this point in my sobriety where I'm so aware of what I'm doing. I think for a long time I would feed myself or whatever. I would think that, I don't need to sound insane. I feed myself thoughts, whatever. I would have the thought, I would have the scary or the fear-based thought that I want something and I'm not sure if I'm going to get it. And I wouldn't even know. I would have no idea that I was lying to myself or making myself miserable because I could. Because that's what the groove in my brain wants to do. And because, honestly, I believe that's alcoholism. So now I'm at the point where I understand that I'm doing it, but it's just crazy. It's like my brain, I'll be fine, and then my brain goes, you're supposed to be depressed. You've got this thing going on. And then I go, then I think, no, you're fine. Remember, you can't control this. You don't even know if it's a good thing to have anyway. It's so weird. It is so weird living like this. And you know, it's not great. It's not great right at this moment, but it's certainly not terrible. So that's what's going on with me. I'd love to introduce you to my guest today. His name is Rich Scheidner. He is a longtime comic. He began in the 80s. He was on Letterman. He was on Carson. He was on Leno. He did HBO specials. He was on Married with Children. He played Al Bundy's coworker. Do you remember that? And then he wrote on a bunch of TV shows, including Roseanne and The Jeff Foxworthy Show, The Mind of the Married Man. And so then he did a book called I Killed that's about comedy. And then he made this documentary that I saw. And this is the thing that got me super excited to interview him. I was excited already, but please go see I Am Comic. It's on iTunes. And it's basically about him. It was supposed to be, it's sort of ostensibly a documentary about comedy, but the director kind of shifted and made it about him. You know how in Exit Through the Gift Shop, that Banksy documentary, it starts off being a documentary about Banksy and then it kind of ends up being a documentary about that other guy? can't remember his name or whatever his, the thing he went by was, but this is like that. And it's, and it captures Rich deciding to go back into comedy. I mean, I don't want to ruin it for you, but check it out. And he's sober over 30 years. I think that he is the reigning sobriety champion on this podcast. And, you know, liked his alcohol, liked a lot of other things, but, you know, and we get into that and a whole bunch of other things. So now I give you Rich Scheidner.
I first started taking drugs by chewing blocks of hash.
Oh my God. I think my copy has like blood stains on it from shooting up while reading it.
Party animal. I hate to say that because that makes me sound Paris Hilton-y. I was on the, as right. I call it, the Autobahn to nowhere.
I'm very lucky because would you have wanted to have a celebrity junkie for a dad?
We're super casually.
Yes, we're starting. We've started.
Okay.
It's very dramatic. I'll tell you what that is. That is this speech. So we're talking about this thing on my wall. I'm wondering how many people know about this. This thing that starts, our greatest fear is not that we're inadequate, but that we're powerful beyond measure. And it's something that Marianne Williamson has gotten credit for.
Yeah.
But it was Nelson Mandela.
Ah.
Maybe it's the other way around. Maybe he's gotten...
If I'm going to go for source, Mandela, Marianne Williamson,
yeah.
I'm going Mandela.
I know.
Just as a shot there.
No, I think you're right. I can't remember for sure. I think, I don't know if you're a gambling man, but that, I think you're safe with that bet.
I'm safe with that bet.
But it's amazing. I mean, because it's such an interesting idea that, like, we're not scared of not being enough. We're scared of being too much.
Yeah.
I don't know if I believe it all the time. Do you believe that?
It's a great one to go with.
Yeah, it is, huh?
I don't know. You know, most of the time I feel like I'm Salieri. You know, I'm able to recognize greatness, but not really able to achieve it.
Do you feel like that?
Oh, yeah. Cursed with, like, ambition, but not the talent to pull it off.
That's ridiculous. You're so talented.
But I'm telling you, that's my feeling. That's
right.
You know, self-doubt, I mean, it drives us on. I mean, that's...
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You know,
satisfaction kills ambition.
I know.
And so I don't complain about it anymore. I know it's just my default mode.
Right. I mean, I relate to that a lot, you know, of just wanting to be more talented.
Yeah, better.
Yeah.
Better. Just want to be better.
Yeah.
Better than I am.
Yeah.
Which drove me out of Pennsville, New Jersey.
Well, and did it drive you out of comedy for a while? Because you're... Okay, so I love that documentary.
Yeah.
I Am Comic. If anyone has not seen it.
Oh, that's nice.
It was
Jordan
not...
did a great job. Jordan Brady, the director.
Well, yeah,
he did a great job.
He did. But so did you.
Yeah.
I will tell you, I went to some trouble and expense to see it because it wasn't on Netflix. I couldn't find it on Netflix. I might have been there. I'm not that great with, like, tech things. I found it on iTunes.
That's right.
So I rented it twice.
Wow.
I know. That's devotion. I was so into it because, like, I didn't finish it one night. I thought, whatever the rental state doesn't stay, you got to do it again. And that was a little bit about how you'd left comedy and it was catching you in the transition to come back.
Right.
Which is interesting.
Right.
So tell me about that.
Well, when I left it, and I think it kind of touched on it, but it really was about my kids. You know, I didn't want to be a guy on the road all the time and come home to kids.
You didn't focus on that.
Yeah, I did. It touched on a little bit. I didn't want to have my family in storage here, you know, and see them once a month or twice a month.
Right.
While I'm on the road all the time to support them living here.
Right.
So I got into writing. I had no idea what the actual performing did for me. I sort of like did not honor it, how important it was to me to hear those laughs, to go out there and strive and get those laughs, and how important it was to my psyche. I found out the hard way. I mean, within months of going into the writing room on a Roseanne television show, I was on antidepressants, which had nothing to do, I don't think. I think it was everything that kind of caught up with me over my life, but it really didn't have anything to do with the situation of the Roseanne show as opposed to the Becker show or any other show
that
I wrote for. It really had to do with that I needed stand-up.
And so you're not on medication anymore?
No.
So stand-up is your medication?
Stand up, exercise. Well, of course, you know, my number one thing is sobriety.
Yes.
I have to be sober. That's the table everything's set on.
Which you were not sober when you were.
Oh, no,
those
I was
shows.
Sober.
Right.
Oh, yeah, I was sober.
Yeah.
Sober. And but the sobriety, then prayer, meditation, exercise, and the performance. I mean, it just does something for me. it always made me feel, I've always felt distant and separate from people and outsider and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And it brings me in the circle.
How much do you, first of all, how long are you sober?
May 11th, 1985. So I'll be 30 years in May 11th.
Jesus Christ.
And I'm older than you too.
But nevertheless, that is a, like, you have more sobriety. I mean, we've had people with 27 years, mm-hmm. But you beat them.
Yeah.
Beating them is good. But how much do you think not feeling a part of is part of alcoholism?
I don't know, chicken and egg for me. I don't know which came first. I had my background, my growing up. My dad was an alcoholic. He was violent when he was drunk.
Yeah.
I had, from the violence, I had panic attacks from my earliest age. I didn't recognize him as that, but that's what I had. And so I always felt that way. And I don't know whether, you know, the drink, you know, panic attacks left me when I started drinking when I was around 11 or 12 years old, mm-hmm. around 11.
Mm-hmm.
And didn't come back until I quit drinking. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Then they
so
came
now
back.
You deal with them?
I deal with them.
Really?
Yeah. And they're all manageable. It's not like the ones that maybe some people have to go to the hospital or something. I mean, I feel like I'm in a glass coffin and I can't breathe and I'm sort of locked down laying there. And it's scary. But I have my prayers and I have, the knowledge it'll pass.
Yeah.
Because it's passed every time.
Yeah.
But it doesn't, when you're in it, sometimes you're thinking, this is it.
Well, when I'm in anything, I think
okay. That's true.
Right? I mean, isn't that alcoholism?
That's a good one, Anna. I like that.
No, I mean, I didn't.
I like
it up,
that. No. I think this is it, and the way it's going to stay, and the way I want it to stay.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Sometimes.
I mean, I think it's more for me. It's more the other one where I get down and I think it's never going to end, even though I have tons of sober experience of it ending.
That's right.
This time it's different, my head says.
Hey, look, just a couple of days ago, I was in the barrel. I just call it being in the barrel. It's my turn in the barrel.
Right, right.
Get in the barrel and go over the falls.
Right, and that just means that
it's
it
just
hits.
I'm going down the rat hole, and I'm getting down, getting depressed, whatever. My head's on me. I try to do everything I can to fight it, going to meetings and all. I do everything I can, but I know I just have to go through it. I'm an up and down person.
Me too.
But you know, when I was in the meds, and this is just my opinion again. I have not a doctor, but I was in a band with. It took away the lows. It put a ceiling on my highs too, and that's where my creativity is.
Yeah, I hear lots of people say that.
And so I had to give up the creativity to put a floor to my depression, and put me in a band with, and it. I mean, you can ask people who've known me for a long time. And the difference was, I didn't realize how big it was. They did.
They saw. People noticed. They said noticed. You were less creative.
I was less me. I was less me in every way. I was less me in every way. I was less vital in every way.
How long were you on the meds?
15, 16 years.
Wow.
I went to see all sorts of psychiatrists. I had diagnoses of PTSD.
Yeah.
Bipolar. Clinical depression.
Yeah.
And the hypnosis. They thought at first for a long time that my symptoms meant that I had been sexually abused.
Yeah.
I had no memories of it.
Right.
Did the whole thing. Hypnosis, all sorts of things to find out whether I had any unrecovered memories, so to speak. None. Nothing. And then this one psychiatrist said it's the symptoms are the same for violence in an early age that you had. And the symptoms are the same for sexual abuse and that. They're the same. So that was it.
We have I've had all those diagnoses and the same thing. And went through every sort of hypnosis, like, did this happen? And it's like been determined. It's like, no.
No.
At this point, we are 100% sure this did not happen to you.
Right.
But that's a scary place to be.
It was. It was for a while. I just couldn't get out of it for a long time.
Yeah.
And I had, whatever the journey was. I stayed sober through it all, which is the important thing.
Yeah.
That was the important thing.
So how long have you been off the meds?
Since 2011.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it...
Almost 4 years.
And it's working.
Working. It's working, man. It's working.
So, tell me about when you first started drinking at 11 or 12.
Yeah.
And how did that come to be? I mean, your dad
worked
drank.
Immediately. Yeah. Yeah. And it was like, it was everything that everybody who's an alcoholic, problem drinker has ever said.
Yeah.
Immediately.
Yeah.
I found the relief I was looking for my whole life. I mean, I did things alcoholic before that. Like, do you ever do a thing when you're young called knockout where you would breathe real fast and somebody would grab you from behind and you'd hold your breath and they'd squeeze your chest. Yeah. You'd pass out from lack of... when I found that, I was like, I couldn't get enough people to do that to me. Come on, I want to get knocked out. I would anything that would get me out. I was looking for a change of perception before I found alcohol. Alcohol worked immediately, and it was on. It was on.
Yeah, we did that. We did a different version where you, somebody kind of chokes you against a wall. I kind of hated it.
A little updated version.
Yeah, I kind of hated
it. It knocked me out, and that's all I cared.
Yeah.
I just wanted to be out.
Yeah.
I wanted to be out of myself, out of my head. And so it worked. And then I went through the progression of drugs like, you know, like J. Edgar Hoover predicted I would, like the FBI said I would. I went through, you know, right up the scale.
Right.
Marijuana, pills, other drugs.
Was drinking your main meal always like your first love?
If we were doing mushrooms, I wanted to be drinking doing mushrooms.
Yeah.
If we were doing acid, I wanted to be doing, you know, MDMA, whatever it was. We can add alcohol to this. You can always add alcohol.
But so your thing, if you mentioned those three drugs, was like a sort of more psychedelic.
No. I like speed. I like uppers. I liked up. I didn't like downers because I wanted to be up out of my head.
Yeah.
And downers, you know, like at the end, I quit pot before anything else because, you know, it just made me paranoid and edgy, kind of skittish, you know.
And dude, we have the same constitution.
Yeah, you know what I mean? So it didn't. So downers
it.
I didn't like.
Yeah.
I needed them when I got too high sometimes. I wanted them around, and I, you know, that was for that. But I'd like to be up out of my head, moving fast.
I like to be moving fast.
I want the car going by the scenery at 1,000 miles an hour. That kind of blur.
Which is interesting.
Not stopped in front of the scenery.
Right. Did you ever do heroin?
Yeah, but I didn't like it.
Yeah, I did it once. I loved it. It's interesting because I feel like the most quote-unquote sped-up seeming people are the ones that gravitate towards the speedy drugs, which you'd think it would be the opposite.
No. Because it focuses me.
Yeah.
Like, I could do speed and think I was writing, but, you know, I was writing, able to write, and now I would have no distractions.
Yeah.
But if I'm smoking pot, I'm distracted by everything, and I got a million things, and I can't do anything.
Yeah.
So it's the opposite. You're right, exactly right. You'd think that we would be attracted to the downers being high, hyperactive people, but no, we're not.
Do people say to you, I can't imagine you on coke, man?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But not anybody was around me. Because people who were around me back then, they know what I was like on coke.
You still in touch with any of those people that were around you then?
The ones that are alive.
Yeah. Did a lot of them die?
Some of them did.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, not, you know, not all of them because of the alcohol and drugs, but yeah, some of them did. And, you know, the people who you know, the alcohol and the drugs, the alcohol and the coke, for me it worked. That was my favorite combination.
Yeah.
You know, Heineken, Jack Daniels, cocaine, Camel non-filter cigarettes.
Yeah.
That's my night.
Yeah.
Comedy and then that until the next time we do comedy.
So do you not remember? Well, cocaine helps you remember.
No, that's one of the reasons why I loved it.
Yeah.
I had speed when I was in high school. I found speed, which I needed because I was a blackout drunk from the beginning.
Right.
And you know, there's the scariest thing. Is the blackout drunk.
Yeah.
I can't imagine being a woman being a blackout drinker.
I never did a lot. Well, because I loved cocaine was my love. So I didn't do it.
Were you a blackout drunk?
Ish. Not really.
No. Okay. See, I know some women who were.
And
their stories are more horrific than mine.
It's true. Right? Yeah.
So when you wake up out of a blackout, it's scary.
Yeah.
So when I found speed back then, I'm so much older than you, but in the 70s, it was white crosses and black beauties.
Yeah.
Then I became a wide awake drunk, which is preferable.
Yeah.
Right? Preferable.
Oh, absolutely. Right. Why not be there for it?
Exactly.
Until it gets horrible.
Well, and we'll find something else to do.
Well, so tell me about when it got horrible. Like, how long were you doing? I'm assuming it got horrible if you stopped.
20 years. 32. I was 32 when I quit.
And so what made you quit?
The truth is it took away the thing I love more than anything. It took away the comedy.
How?
I was angry and bitter. And was no longer able to really enjoy performing on stage.
Right.
And I was not enjoying the audiences. I was not creating any really new material. And I just really was, I'd lost the one thing, you know, that people talk about. Your bottom is, it takes away the one thing you thought you could never live without.
Right.
And I didn't find comedy until I was 24.
Yeah.
And by 8 years later, it took it away. The drugs and alcohol had taken it away. And that was one thing I just couldn't, you know, besides the physicality. I mean, the physical nature of I was bleeding where I shouldn't be bleeding. And I was throwing up. And
bleeding internally?
I was throwing up blood. And there was some other blood coming out of other places.
Okay,
you know,
okay,
it was not fun.
Enough.
Enough. You get the point.
Yeah, I get it.
So physically, I was a little bloated and little problems physically.
Yeah.
But the main thing was it taken away the comedy.
And so, because you were immediately successful with comedy, when you...
No. I started in 77.
Okay.
There were no comedy clubs in Washington, D.C. I moved to New York, 79. So what happened was I did kind of get out of the gate fast because the comedy clubs exploded in 80.
Yeah.
Like in 79, no, there were like 3 paying comedy clubs in the whole country.
Yeah.
2 on the West Coast, 1 in Washington, D.C.
Right.
1980, there are hundreds. They're popping up
how
like crazy.
The year, huh?
So I was ready because I've been doing it for 3 years. I was ready to hit that wave.
Yeah.
There were guys like me and my generation who were ready to hit that wave.
Yeah.
Because I was really ambitious about how much material I would have. I always wanted to come up with new ideas, and that's what I felt like. I was a writer more than a performer.
Mm-hmm.
And so when it happened, I had time. I could go on stage for a long time.
Yeah.
And that's what the clubs needed. They had packed audiences. They needed comics who could hold that audience.
Right.
Hold them.
And so what did you start doing? So you were in New York, is that what you said, or D.C.?
Yeah, I was living in New York.
And so what were the, like, Carolines, like, what were those?
No, Carolines didn't know until later. No, the clubs there were Catch a Rising Star, The Improvisation, and the Comic Strip. But they weren't paying clubs. Then the clubs opened up in Canada, the Yuck Yucks in Toronto, and Montreal, and Ottawa, and Cleveland, Detroit, Washington, D.C., Philadelphia, Boston. All these clubs started popping up all over the place.
Yeah, and it was
Atlanta.
Good money?
Oh, yeah. The money started just, it doubled, then it tripled. Yeah. And you'd come back and you could do more time. You could do the time. You could hold them. They wanted them there drinking. This is before the drinking laws changed for drunk driving.
Oh, geez.
So they would be like, let's hold them here and keep them drinking as long as possible.
Right.
How much liquor can we sell to these people?
What do you mean laws changed for drunk driving?
Well, like, Mad, Mothers Against Drunk Driving came on in the 80s.
Yeah.
And I saw it change. And it was great because I quit drinking in 85 and I saw the change of attitudes. Because before that, like in the 70s, I mean, I did so much drunk driving in the 70s and virtually, you know, most times you'd pull you over, you've been in an accident.
Yeah.
They go, oh, he's suffered enough, he's been in an accident. You know, let's just, you know, forget all the beer bottles and the liquor bottles in the floor. He's suffered enough, don't bother with him, you know. Or if you're so drunk driving, they pull you over, you've been drinking? Yeah. Well, you think you can make it home? Yeah. All right, go straight home. Don't go to the bars now.
Right.
Go straight home. Okay, I'm going straight home, officer.
It's kind of
that
terrifying.
Happened all the time.
Were there more drunk driving accidents? Do we know?
No, I don't think there were more. I think there may have been more.
There were a lot.
There were a lot. And they weren't credited. They weren't going, oh, that was a drunk driver. No,
yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They didn't. It wasn't like that.
Yeah.
There was, I mean, you really had to be out of control and do, you know, you fall out of the car with a bottle in your hand and a severed hand in the other one, you know? You know what I mean? You really had to be, and I mean, I know people got DUIs back then, but you.
You had to work to get them.
Yeah,
it's interesting. My dad got him in the 70s, and he's not, I don't even think he's an alcoholic. But he, I swear to God, and that isn't somewhere to
tell. Just said that he had to work. I think he worked for it.
No, he worked for it, but you know, he's got a billion other issues, so who knows. But yeah, no, I remember it was like really crazy. But I'll tell you, I got pulled up. No, I didn't. I left in after hours. This was in 2000, let's say it's 1999, and I... wasted 3 a.m, cocaine, drunk. I had parked my car. I feel like I've told this story on the podcast, so I almost want to stop it for anyone who's annoyed. Oh, yeah, I've totally told it. Parked off of Hollywood Boulevard, like around here, lost my car, saw a cop, waved him down, said, I lost my car, will you drive me to it? And he did. He's like, have a good night.
I was going to go see the Allman Brothers play in Philadelphia in 1970.
Mm-hmm.
4 of us in the car. I was so drunk that the other guy let me drive because he was too drunk to drive.
Right.
I was drunk. We got in a huge accident on the Walt Whitman Bridge in Philly.
Yeah.
Pile up. I broke my wrist, cut out. My hand is hanging off to the side.
Yeah.
I get out of the car. I'm so drunk I don't even know it. This other couple goes, look at your wrist. Whoa.
Yeah.
Got beer bottles and beer cans all over the floor of our car.
Yeah.
Right? Cop comes. I'm drunk as hell.
Yeah.
Goes, oh, that's too bad about your hand. Looks in there. He looks in my car. Goes, well, forget all that stuff. Let's go. Takes me to the hospital. Gets my cast set. Waits for me. I got pills from the doctor. And then takes me right to the Spectrum to see the concert.
Oh, my God. That's wonderful.
That's a little different attitude in 1970 than maybe today.
Yeah. Yeah.
Didn't even bother me for the drinking and the driving. I got in a crash.
That's crazy.
Right.
That's crazy. So, okay. So there you are doing comedy. Drinking and driving.
No, see, that's the beauty about...
New York.
New York, no drinking and driving. That saved my life.
Yeah.
Right? Then I came to L.A., I started having some problems with it.
Yeah.
Right? But I tried to minimize it. When you're on the road, you have to worry about it because people are driving you around. You have other drunks to drive you.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah. I think a lot more people get sober in L.A. than New York because they get sent there on a court car.
The drunk driving, that's right.
And they're like, oh, wait a minute.
That's right.
Wait a minute, I relate.
I had so many whiskey dents on my car.
Yeah.
You know, I'd wake up in the morning and it was just like, well, that was bound to happen.
Yeah.
You know, bumpers hanging off, the dent on this one. Oh, I must have hit something.
So, okay, so tell me about the comedy and the drinking and all that stuff. So it starts, boom, comedy boom.
Yeah.
And so you're doing it.
Yeah, I'm doing it. And I didn't drink or do drugs on stage. I mean, it happens sometimes.
Yeah.
But it would be a mistake or an accident. Like you know, I was doing acid with my girlfriend and camping, and we came back, and I, you know, just didn't time it right.
Yeah.
And I'm going on stage, I'm still tripping. Or I was backstage, I was opening up for Peter Tosh. You know who he is?
No.
Peter Tosh was one of the Wailers. You know who Bob Marley is?
Yeah.
Well, I was a huge Bob Marley fan. Okay. 81, Marley died. Peter Tosh, a lot of the Wailers started going out on the road themselves. So I was an opening act for Peter Tosh.
That's awesome.
So I'm backstage. Buddy of mine, Rich Hall, is a comic. He warned me. He said, listen, man, whatever you do, don't hang out backstage with these guys. I got a contact. I can barely do my show.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, he doesn't drink or do drugs like I do. And I can handle this. Backstage, one of these Rastafarians. I never hung out with Rastafarians, right. You know. They're these dread, like, hey, I'm funny, man. Come over here a minute. And they hand me a joint, a split, right? It's like a sawed-off baseball bat.
Yeah.
And the pot was Jamaican. I mean, I'm used to, like, you know, $20 ragweed, you know.
Right.
So I got so high. They introduced me and sounded like I was being introduced underwater. You know what I mean? And I go to the stage. My buddy told me yesterday, you came out of the stage laughing. The whole audience is laughing. The only thing that saved me, the audience was as high as I was.
Yeah, exactly.
So my buddy said, you didn't do a joke for 15 minutes. You just laughed. They laughed and you left. But, you know, but mostly it was the after hours and in between.
Yeah.
When I drank and did so much drugs. And it was so much available. And we, you know, we were little rock stars running around.
Yeah.
Doing comedy back then.
Yeah.
And so you'd come into town Tuesday night, maybe the first show. Well, every drug dealer in town is out. All the hipsters are out.
Yeah.
To come see your show. And you'd come off stage, people would just be handling, you know, little snow packs, you know, little snow seals.
Yeah.
Here's a gram. Here's a, just handed to you as you walk past.
Yeah.
And then you'd go hang out with the drug dealers for a couple of days. And you never paid for much of anything you did.
Well, and plus, there weren't so many comedians around.
No, that's very rare. There were only 400 in the whole country.
Right.
400 in the whole country. That's from the top, like Steve Martin, Richard Pryor, down to the bottom in 79.
Yeah.
There's 400 in Toledo now.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So we were rare, and we were. That's what I'm saying. The whole thing exploded.
Yeah.
And Rolling Stone magazine did an article saying, you know, stand-up comedy is the rock and roll of the 80s.
Yeah.
We were like, you know, it exploded.
Yeah.
So the first few times you come through town, people are like, wow, man, you guys are rock stars. We haven't seen anything like this.
Yeah. And so what happened from there? You started going on Leno pretty fast, right?
I did Johnny Carson in 84.
Yeah.
And then Letterman. I did everything I was supposed to do.
Yeah.
You know, HBO special, all that stuff. Everything I was supposed to do. TV pilots, the whole thing.
Yeah. And then when did you start writing on those TV shows?
When I quit. And, you know, I got around 94. I got, you know, I knew it wasn't going to happen. I had my last pilot. Didn't get turned into a series.
Yeah.
I'd had, you know, there were only four channels. I'd had five deals.
Right.
So you know, I had twice I'd failed on CBS. My agent's like, it's not going to happen for you, man. You're not getting another deal. You're not getting another sitcom where you're the star.
Yeah.
And so I headed back out on the road, and I got one night I'm doing this South Carolina club, and I get heckled. This guy's good heckle, man. Like funny, you know, like you could play with him.
Yeah.
And I got this rhythm with this guy where I'd play with him all night long. I'd do material, he'd pull back. Man, he was smart.
Yeah.
To let me do my material. I'd take a pause. I'd go grab water on the piano and look at him, and he'd come back and we'd play. Scored huge, you know. At the end of the night, I come off stage, I go to the club owner. I go, man, that guy was a great heckler, man. He goes, you know who that was? I go, no. He goes, it's Sean Penn. I go, what? He goes, yeah, Sean Penn, man. He wants to hang out with you. So go back
it's
in the
crazy,
office.
Yeah.
Sean Penn's there with these two young gals. He's wired, man.
Yeah.
He's waxed, you know. And we hang out, you know. In my mind, I'm thinking, I'm hanging out with Sean Penn, man.
Yeah.
He gets me, man.
Yeah.
5 a.m, I can't hang anymore. I'm just drinking Diet Cokes, you know.
Yeah.
I said, I got to go, man. I got to go, man. He said, hey, man, before you go, buddy, I got some advice for you. I go, yeah, what's that? He says, you should move to L.A. I go, I've been living in L.A. for 10 years now, and this guy doesn't know who I was.
Right.
I thought he knew who I was.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Like, yeah.
He just thought I was the funniest guy in South Carolina that night.
Yeah.
I go, that realized I went, I'm not making a dent in this business.
Well.
No, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
it just was it was like a reality thing. I go,
yeah.
And now I got these two. You know, I got a girl. You know, I got a little daughter. You know,
yeah.
And, you know, I got to get off. Stop this illusion. You know, stop this fantasy that I'm going to become a stand-up star and go do some writing and get serious and try to, you know, make some money and stay home.
And was it a big transition to?
That was a huge transition. Huge. That's what I said.
To get a TV job.
Well, no, it was ridiculously easy.
Because you knew everybody.
And I called up everybody who had a show back then, and I had a lot of friends that had shows. And
yeah.
I called up Roseanne, yeah. one of the people, and she called me back that night. And said, "You want a job? Yeah. Come to the studio tomorrow."
Yeah.
And I had a job.
Yeah.
And that started me going. But yeah, mine was sober when I kind of quit doing stand-up for that time period. I was sober.
Yeah.
But the transition from being drinking and drugging, doing stand-up to sober stand-up, that was huge too.
Yeah.
I was angry.
Really?
Oh, my God, yeah. Because even if I was going to drink after the show, right?
Yeah.
I'd have Coke in my pocket. I'd have that security knowing I'm going to drink afterwards. And I was detoxed. I didn't go to rehab.
You didn't?
1985, no, there was rehab, but...
Yeah.
I didn't know
Nobody
about
did
it.
That.
Nobody
yeah.
did it.
Yeah.
It's like I was just sweating out on a couch in West Hollywood, you know, and I was angry. I'd go on stage and I'd throw the mic down and storm off, and Bud Freeman, God bless him, man, at the Improv kept putting me on night after night, giving me a good spot.
Right.
And I thought, man, I thought for a while I was done. I thought, I can't get over this, you know. Like a buddy of mine told me once, I was on stage and I was ranting angrily and nobody was laughing.
Yeah.
And I didn't know him right at the time, but he was just one of the people in the audience. And he laughed at something I said. And I turned to him and I went, "What are you laughing at?" Like, I was like completely out of my mind.
So wait a minute. So you decided to get sober. Was it a bad night or was it a succession of bad nights?
It was a succession of bad nights.
Why that day then?
Why what day?
The day you did it.
Why did they decide to get sober?
Yeah.
It wasn't a day I decided. I just couldn't do it anymore.
Right, your body
but
just
I had
out.
To keep, but I didn't know what else to do but I side stand up.
Yeah.
To make a living or even what I did. I mean, stand up was who I was stand up.
Yeah.
So the getting sober is like, well, I got to go back on stage, but I was ill equipped for it. You know, it was emotionally, I was, you know, I mean, physically, my descent, my bottom was the opposite of my recovery. You know, like,
yeah.
I never had an essence of spirituality in me or any kind of belief in God
yeah.
from the earliest age.
Yeah.
I was emotionally shot. And then physically, at the end, I couldn't drink or do drugs anymore. Physically, was beaten.
Right.
So when I get in recovery, the first thing that comes back is the physicality. You start getting a little bouncy, your step. You know, you get all the toxins out of your body.
Yeah.
You're not drinking and doing drugs anymore. You start feeling a little bit of power again, right?
Yeah.
Then emotionally, that's the next thing I had to work, and I was out of my mind.
Yeah.
Angry, frustrated, all the stuff that I drank and did drugs to avoid was on my back.
Yeah.
On my ass.
Yeah.
So it was hard to go up and perform, and it took me a while to get it, you know, to get it back, you know. So as being sober, you know, going into meetings, and I'd be in an improv in the daytime, you know, and with a group of people trying to get sober, you know, and then I'd go back at night. Trying to make them another group of people laugh.
Right.
I mean, it was just it was a tough transition, but it came and happened. You know, mm-hmm. I persevered because I stuck with that. So I'm going to stay sober no matter what, and I'm going to get back on stage and be funny no matter what.
Yeah, what gave you that perseverance to stay sober?
Desperation.
Yeah.
I couldn't drink and do it. I tried. I tried every way possible not to drink. I tried every combination.
Yeah.
Don't do this, do that. It was like classic.
Yeah.
It was classic. I tried everything. So I knew it. And I got sober for a little while,
mm-hmm.
right? And then went out,
mm-hmm.
which proved to me.
Yeah.
You know, proved to me that I had like one drink and I was gone again, man.
Gone meaning?
I'm telling everybody, there was a benefit down in Austin, Texas, for a club owner.
Uh-huh.
And a bunch of my buddies were all down there, Bill Hicks, a whole bunch of people were doing this benefit. And they're all drinking and drugging. And I drank and drugged with them for years. And
yeah.
I come in here going, I'm not drinking and doing drugs.
Yeah.
But I'm going to hang out and I'm going to bartend.
Yeah.
And I'm going to cut up the Coke and do the Coke lines for you.
Oh, that's crazy.
Well, you know how that ended up.
Yeah.
One tray of drinks comes with an extra Heineken. I grab that and I'm gone.
How long did you stay out?
A week.
Okay.
And the end of it was like a bad country western song. I mean, I was in a bed in this comedy condo in Columbia, South Carolina, and they sent, and I couldn't get out of bed to go to the next gig. I was so sick and so toxic, I couldn't get out. I had not slept in days, and I was just, and this young kid came and carried me in the car, put me in the back seat of a car to drive me to, I don't know where it was, some other place in South Carolina.
Yeah.
To do this gig, and I was like throwing up and telling him, you know, stop the car, man.
Right.
You're going too fast. Well,
right.
Sir, I got to do at least 55. We're on the highway, you know.
Right.
We're on the freeway, man. I said, no, man, slow it down.
So when did it get easier, the sobriety thing?
Time. It just took time, you know. I just kept doing it. When I started writing new material and stuff started coming to me new. That was a big fear.
Mm-hmm.
I think every comic goes through that fear. I don't think any musician wakes up any day and fears that they'll no longer know how to play the instrument. Like, I don't think Eric Clapton ever wakes up and goes, yeah, I don't think I can play the guitar today.
Well, he got sober, so maybe
he did. He might have.
Yeah.
When he was doing it. But comics have that fear of, like, maybe one day I won't be funny.
Yeah.
Like, I could just, it's like a, you know, kind of a weird little thing, a little mixture that I'm not, maybe I could throw it off one day and lose it completely. Because they've seen other comics do that, you know, just lose the funny.
Well, I think anybody in a creative field can be like, well, I may not lose the ability to write, or I may not lose the ability to play guitar, but it might suck. Do you know what I mean?
Like, same difference.
Yeah,
but you're right.
It's the same
thing. You're right.
You know, and I remember sitting in rehab and going, not just I was scared to write, but I figured it would be such a trigger. You know,
because you like to write and get high?
Well, writing in quotes. I would, like you talked about with the speed, like, I would do coke. I was like, I'm just going to do two lines, you know, get the creativity flowing, you know, whatever. And then, that would be okay, except I wouldn't be high enough. So then I'd do two more lines, and then it's like 2 grams, and I've rewritten the same line 30 times.
It's like The Shining, all work and no play makes Jill a dull girl kind of stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It was just like... Yeah. You know, that, but I thought I needed it.
Yeah.
Still.
Yeah.
Even though it was entirely ineffective.
Yeah.
You know, it was effective at first, and by at first, I mean one night, maybe. One really, I stayed up all night writing a TV spec for a show I'd never seen, but it was really good. No, I'm serious.
You know what I did once? I had auditioned for, they were doing an adaptation of a book called The Hitchhiker's Guide
to the Galaxy,
right?
Yeah.
So I had the script. Mm-hmm. I spent all night rewriting the script for my audition the next day. Right? I didn't write. The writer's in the room. The guy's in the room.
And so you went in and did it?
I said, this script is, I read the book. My book's great. This is no good. But I fixed it for you. Let me read my scene. Thank you. Thank you. Good night. Thank you.
That's
my
amazing.
Agent calls me up. What are you, out of your mind?
You're like,
I clinically, yeah, probably. But
so... Okay, and so then you're doing...
Look, you know, this amazing thing we're talking about, because I thought for years that the drugs and alcohol gave me the edge.
Yeah.
They gave me the edge.
Yeah.
Right? And that it was an important part of the process.
Yeah.
That it opened doors and smashed windows and places that put me in places I couldn't go normally.
Yeah.
And may have done it, like you said at the very beginning, may have done that for me. But at the end, when I got sober, I found out I was funny in spite of the alcohol and drugs.
Yeah.
And not because of them.
Yeah.
And that was a huge revelation. When I had that, I went, oh, I'm not looking back now.
Yeah.
I'm better now without the alcohol and drugs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's weird. It's strange to realize that. I mean, well, and also the edge thing, I do feel like I hear a lot. I am on medication, but like I hear people who say it's sort of similar to what you said, is like they fear they'll lose their edge if they get on medication. Right?
Yeah. It put me in a bandwidth. I don't want to say an edge because that may be talking about two different things.
Yeah.
But it dulled
you're
me down
happy.
A little bit. It dulled me down a little bit. You know? And it puts you in a little bit of a tighter bandwidth, which is probably necessary. And I'm not saying, I mean, some people need, I don't want anybody killing themselves.
Yeah.
You know, if they don't take the medication they need. But for me personally, once I got off it.
Yeah.
A few years ago, doing things that I hadn't been wanting to do for a long, long time, creatively.
Really?
That I did not do and wasn't even seeing.
I think that's
10 years ago.
Very courageous. I think the idea of being on meds for 15 years and getting off of it is as courageous as getting sober, to me.
Well, I mean, it was necessary for me.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Both of them were necessary. So I really don't look at them as acts of courage, but they were both really necessary, Anna.
Well, it is true that, you know, I don't look at getting sober as an act of courage. I think people outside, you know how people outside of it are like, it's so hard what you're doing. And you're like, no, the other way was hard.
Yeah.
Compared, this is easy. You know.
Or some people look at it and they go like, good for you. That kind of patronizing.
Yeah.
That's good for you.
Yeah, you know.
That's good for you.
Or it's, like, ugh, I speak at colleges sometimes about addiction and they'll come up and be like, I'm so sorry your life has been so hard kind of a thing. And I'm just like, oh, well, don't pity me.
Anyway, I think there's a whole thing of people who get sober that it's like they want applause for not doing things they shouldn't be doing anyway.
Right.
You mean you're not getting drunk and driving through a school zone at 100 miles an hour?
Right.
How about a stand ovation for that car? Right?
I know. It's true. Like, I do remember that at first. First of all, I want a standing ovation for everything. I do. I recently went to court to take care of a traffic violation.
Uh-huh.
I wanted a fucking medal. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's because it's like this just immaturity.
Yeah, it's true. It's
you
true.
Know?
I'm that way. And you'd think at 62 I wouldn't be that immature anymore.
You look good, dude.
But
62.
I put up a good show.
Yeah, I mean, if it's a
Hollywood
show.
Hollywood storefront, baby.
Yeah. But so
yoga, I think, is my new.
Oh, is that your new addiction, as they say?
Yeah, it's not a new addiction, but I've added it. You know, for years I just did push-ups and sit-ups and ran.
Yeah,
like classic, you know, 70s dude
shit.
Yeah, exercise.
Yeah,
but I got convinced to try yoga a few years ago. I see the point.
You do.
I see the point. It stretches me.
Yeah,
and it does a different thing, you know, with the instead of like, you know, moving 100 miles an hour, it causes me to concentrate in a different way.
Yeah,
and it's great, and it stretches me.
So
it stretches me physically.
Yeah.
Exactly. And it's good. I like it.
It's interesting. I've done it enough, but it's bad for my back.
Whatever you're doing, you keep doing.
Well, thank you.
Speaking of looking good,
thank you.
You guys out there don't know, this woman is very, very pretty.
Oh, you're very sweet. You're just, you know.
I say it in a fatherly way.
Yes. But
she's blushing now.
You know what? I don't really blush. Am I really blushing?
Here you are.
It's hard to make me blush. Good job, dude.
Came out of nowhere, didn't it?
Yeah. I didn't think I did. I didn't know I was capable.
Yeah, you should have seen your body language.
That I believe. My body language is very expressive. Yeah. You know?
You went very, like, very shy.
Well, I love a compliment, so let's don't miss
Yeah,
me
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Don't stop with a compliment.
Please. I have no fear there. But I do think, whatever. It's not that interesting. But yoga hurt my back, even though it's supposed to be like, whatever. I'm injury prone, you know?
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. And it's interesting. I was just talking to one of my, I didn't even explain. This is all part of a website. See, I love you. Okay, so you asked no questions. You just said yes.
Yes.
And came in here, which I love and appreciate. I'm
so
grateful.
I told you why.
Yeah. They know about Danielle Stewart.
Yeah, Danielle.
She's been on the podcast, and she writes a
She's
ton.
Great.
Amazing.
I really dig her, and she said, hey, do this thing.
Yeah.
You said Danielle Stewart when you emailed her. I'm in.
Yeah. But this is part of a website that's all about addiction and recovery that I edit, that I created, and that I sold. So I'm actually...
Oh, wow.
But yeah. And so those people out there work for me.
Wow.
No, just those two.
Which ones?
The people that are working the hardest. Right over there, the guy and the girl over there with the little red curly
little
hair.
Little red curly hair. Red blouse and curly hair.
Very good. Yeah, I like cute people, you know.
You got them.
So, but anyway, what was my point? I so had one. Who knows?
It'll come around again.
It'll come around again, but it had something to do with how this podcast is part of the site, and I post one of these every week.
Okay.
So it's just like one of the things.
Cool.
I know what I was trying to say. So Ryan and I were talking about chronic pain, because we were talking about how some rehabs treat chronic pain, and he was like, well, what does that mean? You know, because people with chronic pain and the opiates and the painkillers is a real thing out there.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so, anyway, I have some of it, and I have to do, like, all that other shit.
Yeah, it's, again, we get into addiction of it. Like I said, I wasn't a pill head.
Yeah.
But a friend of mine died behind that.
Yeah.
And part of his thing, he would have these phantom pains.
Yeah.
I've got a bad knee,
How
Rich.
Do you know?
I got it. Because he didn't, and he wouldn't. And he'd get sober for a while, and he'd walk around and go, how's your knee? It's fine.
Yeah, it's fine, man. Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like, oh, yeah. But when you're getting high or you want to get high, all of a sudden these injuries manifest themselves almost providentially. It's more than just a coincidence. His mind seemed to manufacture them.
Yeah. No,
so
I think that
he
happens.
Would get the drugs the mind wanted. I don't know. I'm not that deep of anything, but but not a psychiatrist or anything.
But
I'm just watched his thing, and there's something there. I don't know.
Yeah, it's strange. I mean, I had to take painkillers in sobriety because mine and it
people
yeah.
will
yeah
people
yeah.
have
and
to
I hated
and
it
have to yeah
I
right
hated it
yeah
made me so depressed.
You gotta get people have to have somebody else kind of hold the meds for them and all sorts of things to because people have gone out.
Oh, God,
and killed themselves behind that sort of thing. But
yeah.
And it made you depressed, huh?
Yeah, it was a huge decision to do it. And, you know, obviously, and it was such a, I had told my doctor I was sober, my orthopedic. And so then when the pain didn't go away, 3 months, can't walk, all this stuff, I go to him, look, I'm ready, give them to me. And he knew I told him I was sober. So he was totally suspect and sent me to a pain management clinic that was the shadiest place you have ever seen. It was a guy who was not an MD prescribed me the medication. Like, that's how shady it was. And they drug test you when you go there. I mean, it's like so bad. And then a lot of pharmacies don't carry opiates anymore because they don't want to get robbed. So you got to go to a really shady place to even get it filled. It's a whole thing.
Wow.
But
I know they're trying to crack down on it because there's so much.
Yeah,
but
totally.
But then again, there's so much heroin in the country that I'm not really that well versed. But as I understand it, heroin in the street is cheaper than OxyContin.
And easier to get.
Easier to get, exactly.
Yeah, no, that's the real crisis today.
Right. So I mean, it's all, whatever you want, you're going to find.
Yeah. Right? I know. I never really had any trouble finding anything.
No.
So, okay, wait, what were we trying to talk? What was I trying to get you to talk about? I think, okay, so I want to talk about I Am Comic.
Okay.
So how did that come about?
Well, I put out a book with a friend, Mark Schiff, and I put out a book called I Killed.
Yeah.
And it was about road stories, comic road stories.
Yeah.
And Jordan Brady saw that, read that, and Jordan and I knew each other from doing stand-up a long time ago, and Jordan's a director now.
Mm-hmm.
And he came up to me and said, I want to do a movie about stand-up. Mm-hmm. I said, I just don't want to do a book about stand-up stories.
Mm-hmm.
But if we can get into the essence of what it really takes to do stand-up,
mm-hmm.
and what it's about,
mm-hmm.
the things behind it,
mm-hmm.
what the stand-ups get out of it, all that sort of thing, then yeah, I'm in. And he said, mm-hmm. all right, let's do it. So we did it. So we were doing it. And Jordan instinctually knew he needed more to the story than that.
Yeah.
So he just saw my expression a couple of times. We'd be watching comics perform, and I hadn't been in the clubs in a long time.
Yeah.
I'd avoided it for good reason.
Yeah.
Right? I avoided stand-up. Now I'm back in it. You know, to interview these comics.
Because of the travel.
I'm sure. No, I avoided it because I'd quit doing it.
Yeah.
And it would probably be too painful, as turned out to be exactly that, to watch it and not do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I didn't watch it on TV. I didn't go out to the clubs to watch comics.
Yeah.
I just avoided it.
Yeah.
And so now I'm sitting in there, and some nights we'd go watch shows, yeah. then interview comics after the show.
And you showed all that. In the
right. So one night I'm sitting there, and he just looked at my face and went, hey, you want to do it, don't you? I said, yeah I think I'm kind of missing it right now. I'd like to get a bite out of this audience myself.
Yeah.
And that started it. And I didn't even want to go back. And then once we decided to do it, and once he said, come on, go do it.
Yeah.
Then I knew kind of what was going to happen. I knew I was going to bomb something because I wasn't going to go do my own material.
Right.
I said, I'm going to do something different. I got to do something new. Then let's build something new.
And then you came up with that joke.
Keep going.
Wanting to kill the wife or whatever. You know, what's
one,
the joke?
One, I don't know which one it was.
Oh, come on. You talked about it a lot in the documentary. Okay, gosh. It's the one about how you're truly in love and then you don't understand that one day you're going to
that's an old joke. I don't know if I did that joke or not, but that joke was the first joke I got when I got sober.
Yeah.
That's the first joke.
Okay.
That's important, that joke, because I thought I'd never going to write another funny joke.
Yeah.
And I was out jogging. A friend of mine said, why don't you start jogging, start running again? And I was smoking heavy, you know, even when I was sober, sober.
Yeah.
And so I would run with, like, cigarettes in my sock. You know, I'd stop every couple of feet to light a cigarette.
That's so gross. It's like William Hurt's body heat.
Exactly what I thought about. So one day this joke just landed in front of me.
Yeah.
And I took it to the improv that night, and it worked. I said, you know, no matter how much you love each other, no matter how much you need each other, it's going to be these moments in any relationship where one minute you look at the other person, you think to yourself, I want to spend the rest of my life with you.
Yeah.
And your next thought could be, how can I fake my death? Right? And it worked, and it got me back on The Tonight Show. It did a lot of things for me. That joke sort of keyed in a whole bunch of other new stuff behind it, kind of like that.
So, and that's an interesting thing because it sort of sparks the question, do you think that came from, like, a divine power, like a higher power? You know what I mean? Like, do you believe in
like
that?
Like a reward for being sober or,
well, who knows?
Or to help
all,
me?
I do believe in that.
Even though
I don't, like, I totally believe that the universe is like, you're doing the right thing, I'm going to give you this.
Well, I don't know. I just know when I got sober, I got a new clarity and my thinking got a little bit better.
Yeah.
And I was able to cognitively put things together in a better way, in a different way, and look at things differently. And
yeah.
So it was reward for being sober, but I don't have that kind of a God. You know,
yeah.
I grew up with that rewarding, punishing God, you know?
Mine's just rewarding. I'm serious. I got to make him up.
You got the yin, no yang, huh?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
But I grew up, you know, in a Baptist.
Yeah.
So I had to drop both.
Yeah.
I could not just have the one.
Yeah.
So I dropped them both. So I don't have that kind of thing. But, yeah, I get it, you know.
How does your higher power, do you call it higher power? Do you call it God?
My basic belief is that I don't understand everything. That's my basic belief.
You don't understand.
I don't understand everything.
And so.
So anything's possible?
Yeah.
Because I don't understand it all?
Yeah.
So I don't have to, like, worry about it if I don't understand everything?
Yeah.
I'm not trying to control it because there is no ability of me to control anything or everything.
Right.
So in terms of belief system, because every religion is just a system of beliefs to explain the unexplainable.
Yeah.
So I don't have to worry about trying to explain unexplainable. I just accept it.
Yeah.
I can't explain it. I don't understand it.
Yeah.
And there's something working out there that is beyond my concept. That's what always cracks me up. It's like, what are you talking about these gods? Like in a movie, they never get heaven right in a movie. They can never get it because our imaginations are tied to human form.
That's why
they always have in a movie, in a heaven scene, they'll have a gazebo. A gazebo, really? You mean the creator of the universe, the best the creator of the universe come up for you to hang out with is a gazebo?
Right.
Don't you think he'd create something you could not have any concept that this could possibly exist? Of course, you can't come up with it because your imagination is limited to gazebo.
Wouldn't it be
cool if we hung out in a gazebo in heaven? And a train would come by.
Oh, that's really cool.
Exactly. I'm just saying. But that's always cracks me up. So that's why they can never do any kind of effect of heaven in any kind of movie scene, really.
Because
it's all tied to human form.
Yeah.
That's like, you know, early Christianity. The best way to do it. What's heaven going to be? Angels playing harps.
Yeah.
Why? Because I like a guy playing a harp. I think that's kind of cool. So I'm going to put a harp player in heaven. If the guy didn't like harps, it could have made it something else. Hey, an angel playing a Jew's harp. Why? I like Jew's harps. That's why.
Right.
It's all tied to our own imagination. So I just try to go with some sort of God, higher power thing that's beyond my understanding.
Do you believe that helped you get sober?
Helped me stay sober.
Mm-hmm.
What got me sober was the knowledge in my gut, in my very center and core of my lizard brain, that I could not drink without and control the consequences. I could not start to drink and then effectively know whether I was going to stop or not. I could not start to do drugs and have any idea what was going to happen. I knew I could no longer control my drinking or drugging. And that's what got me sober. And I didn't want it anymore. It's ruining my life in every possible way. My marriage was terrible. Everything was bad. I mean, the marriage ended anyway, but at least I did it sober. It expedited it. Yeah, it did.
Did you?
you wake up and you go, whoa, what? What did I do?
How long were you married?
That marriage, I was married. I've been married twice.
Oh, that's right. You were married to twice. Carol.
Yeah, Liefer.
Yeah.
Right. So that marriage lasted from 81 to, I think the divorce was finalized in like 85, 86, something like that.
Right. But what's interesting what you said is that you credit this higher power or whatever with helping you stay sober. Do you have temptations to drink?
No.
Yeah. Do you think that's what it is? I mean, because it doesn't really.
No, because I focus on it all the time, and I do certain things every day, certain prayers, and I go hang out with certain people.
Yeah.
And I do certain things every day to put a focus on the fact that I can't drink or do drugs effectively.
I mean, yes.
So that's what keeps me sober.
Yeah.
And I do give all control over this other person, which helps me to stay sober. This other person, this other thing, this other universe, whatever it is.
Yeah.
I don't worry about it.
Yeah.
That.
Yeah.
I just realized it's not me. That was like one of the things I was taught when I first got sober. Somebody said, because what's your concept of God? I have none. All you have to do is know that you're not God.
Yeah.
I go, okay, that's a good place for me to start.
Yeah. Why not?
That's it.
I just know for me, I find it really hard. I do my practice in the morning, my like meditation, my prayer, and then within 3 minutes, I can absolutely forget everything that I knew for sure 3 minutes before.
Traffic will do that to you in LA. You know that.
Oh, my thoughts will do it to me faster than traffic.
Absolutely. I'm constantly calibrating.
Yeah.
It's not like I set the thing on the dial on 5 and walk out the door and it's 5 an hour later, or it's 5 when I come back.
Right.
The needle's constantly swinging and I'm constantly adjusting.
So
it's like tuning in Tokyo in World War II. Come in Tokyo. I'm just constantly turning the dial, you know.
Yeah, I mean, okay, sorry. I'm obsessing over this because I'm doing it today, like a thing that I've got that's in my mind, and I'm so aware of my monkey mind kind of continuing to go back to this groove that's a lie, b totally fear-based, not a lie, fear-based, and I can't control it anyway. Do you find that where, like,
yeah,
constantly, like every 30
seconds, there's so many great metaphors for this, but I heard a great one in Tennessee years ago in a meeting there.
What's that?
Guy says, I have all these thoughts every day. They come, Nick. I can't control them. It's like sitting on the porch and watching traffic go by in the street.
Yeah.
If I just watch them go by, hey, that's an interesting car. Yeah. Well, that's an interesting motorcycle. Well, that's an interesting truck. Look at that car. Yeah. They're not a problem to me. It's when I try to grab one of the handles on the car that's going past.
Yeah.
And hold on to that car, that thought, then it becomes a problem. And the one thing I learned from this guy a long time ago, he said, whenever my mind tells me things, and it tells me a lot of things during the day, and most of it not good, especially about myself.
Yeah.
My first question to that voice is, where are you getting your information?
Right.
Where are you getting this information?
Right.
And that voice usually shuts up, doesn't come back.
Yeah.
Because it's a voice. It's an old voice.
That's just a little extra time so we can wrap up. But this
okay.
How fun is this?
Oh, I'm having a blast. You're great.
Well, so likewise. So, okay, so, and so right now, what are you, you're doing a one-man show.
Now I'm writing a script for HBO for Bill Maher based on a book that he did called True Story.
Yeah.
So I'm doing that, and I'm writing a book on the 80s comedy.
Okay.
Explosion. So I'm just doing writing and performing. You know, it's just a performance. I do stand-up all the time.
Yeah.
Most of it's, you know, age-based, country clubs and cruise ships. It's, you know, circling the drain comedy tour.
Cruises are fun.
They're all fun. It's all good, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's not like I'm doing it to get ahead or I'm working on my next Jimmy Fallon set or anything like that.
Right.
I understand what I'm doing. It's okay. It's fun.
And you
I still enjoy it.
And you do this recovery comedy thing,
I
find very interesting.
I do that sometimes.
Do you enjoy that?
I love what... But look... You're working in front of the people who get you, and you get them.
Yeah.
There's no better crowd for a comic.
Yeah.
I know who these people are. If I'm standing and performing in front of a bunch of people who are used to drink and do drugs like crazy and now don't a day at a time,
yeah,
I know these people because they're me.
Yeah.
So the jokes I can do for them are like I can do for no other crowd in the world.
And it's let's face it, they love to laugh.
Oh, my God. So we got only a couple things left. That's one of them.
Yeah.
And it's the only thing we can do in a group in public with our clothes on. Absolutely. Look, you get shy again. There she goes again.
Yeah.
She's the, oh, yeah.
Well, so, okay, so any final words for people out there who are, you know, thinking about getting sober, might need to get sober, and you know, any words of wisdom?
Yeah, don't let anybody stop you.
Yeah.
if you're thinking about sober, I mean, I can't, you know, my brother's not an alcoholic.
Yeah.
He never remembers the last beer he has.
Yeah.
He doesn't think about when he's going to have the next one.
Yeah.
Getting sober is not even, what do you mean getting sober? There's nothing to think about.
Yeah.
But if you're thinking about getting sober, you need to get sober. If you're just thinking about it, you need to get sober.
That's so brilliant, too, because it's like, you know, why are you checking it out?
Yeah. I mean, they're probably, somebody's thinking about it, he's been told by other people. I was told by other people I was an alcoholic long before I was willing to admit it myself.
Yeah. Okay, that being said, I do want to make an amendment to that. I do think there are people who, you know, because recovery is such a big topic these days.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I don't know. There could be exceptions.
You get enough people, strangers and friends alike, that over the years have told you you may have a problem the way you drink.
Yeah.
You have a problem the way you act when you're on drugs.
Yeah, let's believe
it. You might want to hear the chorus. You might want to go, you know, none of these people know each other. Some of them didn't even really know me.
Yeah.
They're just somebody I ran into and went, wow, pal. You know, or how do you, I like when you say dude.
Dude, I go through phases of saying dude.
No, I like it.
It's kind
so like, hey,
weird,
dude, you
like
got a little
it.
Problem.
Yeah, dude.
Do you know like the phrase I heard more than anything when I was out there drinking and drugging?
What
are you thinking? What were you thinking? You know what I mean? I wasn't thinking anything. I was just doing what I wanted to do.
I love it. Okay, well, that's a good note to end on. Thank you, Rich. I so appreciate your doing this.
So that was Rich Scheidner. Hope you loved this podcast. Please keep sending me emails, anna@theafterpartygroup.com. I love them and I respond to them and sometimes I'll shout them out here. So do that. Keep listening, subscribe to the podcast, leave a 5-star review if you can, and I will see you next time. Thank you.